homeowners reluctant to sell. Stephen Basaha, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio.
Sam Bush here on Kansas Public Radio with a great song written by Daryl Scott called River Take Me, and before that one Sam wrote with John Pennell called Riding That Bluegrass Train. It's from John's album about 20 years ago called Laps in Seven, and just announced last week the Sam Bush Band going to be at Liberty Hall on April the 4th. Tickets went on sale on Friday for that. Tickets through Ticketmaster.com and at the Liberty Hall box office. I'm Bob McWilliams, and my apologies. We had some technical difficulties, which you may have heard. It didn't sound very good, to put it mildly. And I've charged up here to do this hour of the show live. I do pre-record it, but something was clearly wrong somewhere in the process. And I thank KPR's Jeff Watson for getting some film music on late in the hour until I could get up here. And we're going to be playing some different music than I planned because I had some downloads, including one from Molly Tuttle next. Those are sitting at home and weren't working very well anyway, which is part of the reason of the technical difficulties. Okay, all of that, my apologies. Glad to be here and glad to share the music with you. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the University of Kansas, serving Kansas and the world through research, economic development, and education information about KU programs and initiatives at ku.edu. Here's Vivian Leva. She's a terrific player in the old-timey band The Onlys, but stepped out to do her own album back in 2018 called Time Is Everything. From that, here's a song called No Forever, Vivian Leva on KPR. Vivian Leva on Kansas Public Radio, and she did Cold Mountains, and before that, No Forever, her 2018 album called Time Is Everything. And she is part of the really terrific old-time band The Onlys, have been playing their new album fairly often over the last few weeks and months. And she's also part of a duo with Riley Cagagno of that band, The Onlys. Vivian Leva, out of the Pacific Northwest, really fine singer, banjo player, guitarist as well. With Brooks Williams up next with some acoustic blues for us, we'll be hearing from Chris Waltz. He put out a terrific album last year. He's been a teacher at the Chicago Old School of Folk Music for a long time, masterful instrumentalist, one-time member of the bluegrass band Special Consensus. We'll hear from his album from this last year. And we've got Danny Burns on the way as well as the Irish-Italian-American band Gadan. Well, this month, the KPR Community Spotlight is on Full Circle Sustainability in Topeka on a mission to make low-waste living easier with local and low-waste grocery, soap, refills, recycling, and composting. Info at FullCircleSustainability.org. Well, I knew Brooks Williams when he was just kicking his career off some 30-plus years ago, and a really fine singer-songwriter who, over time, also started diving into a lot of country blues and old-time blues music. And we're going to hear a couple of examples of that from a live album he put out in 2014 called Shreveport Sessions. Brooks Williams, who lives in England now, by the way, came back to the U.S. and did this live concert. And we've got two numbers, one that I first heard Doc Watson do many years ago, 40 years plus ago. Anyway, it's the Delmore Brothers song, Deep River Blues. Here's the Brooks Williams version on Kansas Public Radio. The applause for Brooks Williams, recorded live in Shreveport, Louisiana. 2014 album just called The Shreveport Sessions, and some country blues there for you. The Blind Boy Fuller song Weeping Willow Blues and the Delmore Brothers song, open it up, Deep River Blues, Brooks Williams, on Kansas Public Radio. We've got Danny Burns coming up in a bit. He's a musician from Ireland who came to America quite some time ago and ended up being part of the Nashville Americana and bluegrass music scene. We'll hear from his most recent album as he sings a Tim O'Brien song. And we've got the Irish-Italian American band Gadan that mixes bluegrass and Irish music. Those are on the way. On KPR's Trail Mix, I'm Bob McWilliams. Thank you for joining me. We're here and we are. We're live and we're local. We're live for a change during Trail Mix today, for this hour anyway. We're Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, online at kansaspublicradio.org. Well, here's an album from someone I was not familiar with when the album arrived, Chris Waltz, W-A-L-Z, just like the governor of Minnesota, Waltz, and found out that he's been mostly a teacher in Chicago, an educator at the Old Town School of Folk Music, but boy, he's a dandy flat pick guitarist and really good at other instruments as well. Then I found out he was one of the many musicians who've played with the bluegrass band Special Consensus, but this album is not really a bluegrass album. As such, it's just a real good album of acoustic guitar and songs. It's called All I Got and Gone, and we're going to start off with a version that he pieced together from the many versions of Been All Around This World. It's Chris Waltz on KPR. That's Chris Waltz and Stephen Foster's powerful song, Hard Times Come Again No More. Before that, there's a lot of versions of Been All Around This World or New River and all this kind of stuff, but he put several of those versions together for his version of Been All Around the World, Chris Waltz. One of my favorite albums from this last year, All I Got and Gone, Chris, C-H-R-I-S, Waltz, W-A-L-C. With the Irish-Italian man Gadan up next, the Irish singer in the U.S. and deep into bluegrass and Americana music, Danny Burns after that. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the Lead Center welcoming the Takash Quartet with pianist Joyce Yang. That's Tuesday, 7:30 p.m. Tickets at lead.ku.edu. Well, here's the Irish-Italian-American band, Gadan, and their album from this last year, May the Divil Tune Your Banjos, and they put an Irish twist on an American song, their version of Shady Grove, Gadan, on KPR. Out this last year, the debut album of the band Gadan, and their version, Irish-influenced version of Shady Grove, the album called May the Divil Tune Your Banjos, member from Italy, Ireland, and America, the band Gadan. And Irishman Danny Burns has been in the U.S. for quite a while, and he's deep into the Nashville bluegrass and Americana music scene. We'll hear from Danny next. Well, who doesn't like a party? Well, there's a big party. In fact, a bunch of parties coming up February 27th and 28th. That's to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the KPR Retro Cocktail Hour. There's concerts by L.A. band Nutty and Lawrence's own Exotica Cocktail, and other events as more. Get all the info at kansaspublicradio.org or get your tickets now at Liberty Hall or Ticketmaster. And join us February 27th and 28th for a Retro Cocktail Hour weekend. Let's hear Danny Burns' album, Southern Sky, two songs. The first with such special guests as Sam Bush and Bronwyn Keith Hines. It's Blue Ridge Blue.
Say from up here when the sky's clear, you can see Georgia looking south. But I'd have to climb in a spaceship eating off me. My brother, when he's my way through, he takes me away.
Danny Burns singing Tim O'Brien's Brother Wynn. Before that, Blue Ridge Blue, Danny's recent release, Southern Sky, here on KPR. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from the Crystal Image Photography Studio, offering in-studio and on-location senior pictures, family portraits, professional headshots, and more, serving Lawrence and surrounding areas since 2004. Information and portfolio at tcistudio.com.
Stardate January 18th. A research paper published a couple of years ago featured an ominous title, The Death of Vulcan. A team of astronomers killed off a possible planet around the star 40 Eridani. In the lore of Star Trek, the star is the home of the planet Vulcan. 40 Eridani is actually a triple star. The main star is the one that's supposed to host Vulcan. It's a little smaller and lighter than the Sun, and only about 40% as bright. It's probably older than the Sun, so there's been plenty of time for life to develop on any planets that orbit the star. And in 2018, astronomers reported the possible discovery of one. The planet would have been a super-Earth, about 8 times Earth's mass. But the discovery was tentative, and several follow-ups found little evidence to support it. One concern was that the planet appeared to orbit the star once every 42 days, but that's about the same period as the star's rotation. And according to the 2024 study, that's no coincidence. The earlier study had actually detected activity on the surface of the star. That activity looked like the signal of an orbiting planet, so a possible planet Vulcan vanished in the starlight. 40 Eridani is in the constellation Eridanus, the river. The star is in the southeast at nightfall, well to the upper right of Orion's belt. Under dark skies, the star is visible to the eye alone. We have more sky watching tips, astronomy news, and much more about the universe in Stardate magazine. Details at stardate.org. For the McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
We're here and we are, Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5 KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Oldsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for Trail Mix on KPR comes from Explore Lawrence, celebrating Restaurant Week January 15th to the 25th. Details, including participating restaurants and event menus, online at explorelawrence.com. And the Topeka Symphony presenting Billy the Kid Saturday, featuring Copeland, Boyer, Debussy, and more. Information and tickets available at topekasymphony.org.
I'm Sarah McCammon. We'll talk to three women from different generations of the same family and ask how their opportunities shaped their decisions about having children.
As we got a little older, we began being told that we could have it all and that we should expect to have it all.
Later, after an unlikely rise, Trinidad Chambliss is having quite a moment in college football.
You cannot be a superstar unless you're willing to grow when you're not the guy. He grew all the time, like every day he was trying to get better.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. The Pentagon has placed 1,500 active duty soldiers on standby for possible deployment to Minnesota, NPR has confirmed. This comes as Minnesota Governor Tim Walz mobilized the state's National Guard yesterday to help local law enforcement if needed. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
That official tells NPR that the troops will be coming from Alaska, where they specialize in cold weather operations. It's very cold in Minneapolis right now. Those troops have been placed on prepared to deploy orders in case the situation here escalates. NPR reached out to the Pentagon to confirm. Chief Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said, quote, the Department of War is always prepared to execute the orders of the commander-in-chief if called upon. President Trump threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act last week. But the situation on the ground has been relatively quiet the past few days, and local leaders have urged calm. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Minneapolis.
President Trump is inviting world leaders to join the Board of Peace, a new body that will help rehabilitate Gaza after the war. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports he's seeking broad international powers for the board and billions of dollars from countries that join it.
The United Nations Security Council officially sanctioned the new Board of Peace to oversee the reconstruction of Gaza. But Gaza is not mentioned once in the charter of the new Board of Peace that President Trump will head. NPR has obtained a copy of the charter being distributed. Trump seeks a broad mandate to secure peace in conflict zones, suggesting Trump may wish to use it as a kind of alternative UN to handle other world conflicts in addition to Gaza. The charter appears to criticize the United Nations by calling for, quote, a more nimble and effective international peacebuilding body. The document says permanent member countries must donate at least $1 billion each, and Trump would have broad powers as chairman. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, it will be a shortened holiday trading week with earnings the highlight. NPR's Maria Aspen has more.
U.S. Bank, Fifth Third, and other regional lenders are among the banks reporting earnings. Their bigger rivals say customers are generally, quote, in great shape. So investors are hoping for more signs that consumers are shrugging off inflation and job market uncertainty. But there's another cloud hanging over lenders. President Trump's proposed 10% cap on credit card interest rates. Bankers hate the idea. And card giant Capital One will likely also weigh in as it reports earnings. Other big companies to watch include United Airlines, Intel, which is now partly owned by the U.S. government, and Netflix, which is fighting Paramount to buy Warner Brothers. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. At the Australian Open tennis tournament, Venus Williams has been eliminated in her first round match. Lindsay Arkley has more.
45-year-old Williams accepted a wild card entry into the Australian Open, returning to the tournament after 5 years as the oldest player ever in the singles main draw. Her first round match was against Olga Danilovic of Serbia, ranked 69th in the world and more than two decades younger. Williams took the first set 7-6, but Danilovic fought back, taking the second set 6-3 and the decider 6-4. Williams, who returned to tennis last season after a 16-month break, is still in the doubles draw at the Australian Open, paired with Ekaterina Alexandrova of Russia. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Arkley in Melbourne.
At the weekend box office, James Cameron's Avatar: Fire and Ash took the top spot for the fifth straight weekend, with an estimated $13.3 million in ticket sales. In a close second place, Sony Pictures' horror film, 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, starring Ralph Fiennes and Jack O'Connell, with $13 million. That film cost a reported $63 million to produce. In third place, Disney's Zootopia 2, with $8 million in its eighth weekend. That film is the highest-grossing Animated Motion Picture Association release ever. And in fourth place, The Housemaid, with $8 million. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 44 and cloudy. Wind is from the northwest at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low in the low teens. Wind will be from the north at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 20s. Wind will be from the north at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-teens. Wind will be from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 44 and cloudy. That's KPR weather.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has acknowledged that thousands of people have been killed during weeks of unrest, and some human rights groups put the figure at over 15,000. The demonstrations have been sparked by a financial collapse amid sweeping U.S. sanctions. While protests have eased, tensions remain high. NPR's Jane Arraf joins us now from Amman. Jane, just tell us what's happening in Iran now.
Well, it's still kind of difficult to tell because there has been an extreme blackout of both the phone and internet signals. And that's contributed both to information not getting across the borders and people not being able to leave. But what we do know is that Iranian security forces have managed to suffocate the protests late last week. Both Iranian officials and President Trump said by Thursday that violence had stopped. We're expecting more as Iranians are able to trickle out and give us a better picture of what's happened there.
Is any news trickling out right now?
Well, people have been coming out, a few people, but they are really scared. NPR spoke to Iranians who are coming by bus over the last few days to Turkey. Now, our producer there said they'd never seen people so frightened and almost completely unwilling to talk. One man, as our producer spoke to them, was receiving a phone message from Iranian authorities, a text message of a number to report U.S. and Israeli spies. And he said, "You see, we're being watched and listened to all the time." And in Istanbul, you know, there are a lot of small hotels that are normally full of Iranian tourists. Those are empty. And Iranian expats in Turkey and other countries are still unable to call their families to see if they're okay. There have been hundreds of thousands of Iranian pilgrims still coming across to Iraq by bus on religious pilgrimages to Shia shrines this week. And we've spoken to them there. There are a lot of government supporters, and they, too, were unable to speak openly.
There has been speculation about a possible U.S. attack on Iran. That speculation seems to have died down. But where does this seem to be headed at this point?
Well, it certainly doesn't seem to be over, but it has been, in many people's minds, a temporary reprieve. There's been a lot of worry in the region about Iran collapsing if the U.S. does attack and the far-reaching effects that could have. So countries which aren't traditional allies of Iran are believed to have been advising President Trump not to attack. Now, as you know, the U.S. sent a troop carrier from the South Asia Sea to the Middle East after Trump had threatened Iran if it continued to kill protesters. But he said last week that he had been told that government killings in Iran had stopped. So that pressure seems to have eased a bit. And Iranians on the inside, as we know from previous protests and to some extent to this one, they're worried not just about the extreme government crackdown, but about threats of U.S. action. They're already having an extremely difficult time. These protests, we have to remember, were sparked by a collapsing economy that has left many people literally hungry.
Now, the protests in Iran are not the only thing happening in the region. In Syria, government forces have pushed back U.S.-backed Kurdish troops. Just tell us quickly what's happening there.
Sure. That conflict has been simmering for a while between Syrian government forces, which include Turkish-backed fighters, and Syria's Kurdish-led forces. Now, these are the forces that fought with U.S. troops and defeated ISIS. But they have been discussing with the Syrian government being integrated into Syrian forces, and those talks haven't been going well. So last week, fighting has centered in northern Syria near the city of Aleppo, but it has now moved on into, for instance, some of the biggest oil fields in Syria. The U.S. has said it wants that to stop, and there seems to have been a ceasefire reached, but a ceasefire that will result in the Kurds giving up a lot of control that they've had for more than a decade.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf in Amman, Jordan. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you.
As information from the crackdown in Iran has gotten out, communities around the world have been reacting. Steve Futterman has been reporting for us from Los Angeles, where he's been talking with Iranian Americans at a march downtown today. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Sarah.
So, Steve, what have you been seeing and hearing there in L.A.?
Well, it was a very energized gathering here. Organizers say there were several thousand people in front of City Hall. It's important to know that the largest Iranian population in the U.S. resides in the L.A. area, around 600,000. People here today were carrying flags and all sorts of signs, many of them with the slogan, "Make Iran Great Again." Their main goal is to get rid of the current Islamic government. I spoke to Tina Naemian.
I definitely think the government's going to fall.
When?
Hopefully soon. That's what I'm hoping for. That's what I really want, just to see a big change happen.
Now, she is 22. In the past, there have been differences here between older and younger people of Iranian descent. And while many of those differences may remain, especially any eventual involvement by the family of the former Shah of Iran, the events of the last few weeks seem to have brought people together hoping for that one goal, a change in the leadership. Now, many at today's rally believe President Trump must help and are calling for him to take some action.
You know, as we heard, there's been speculation about U.S. military action in Iran that seems to have calmed a bit. But what do the protesters want to happen next?
Well, it's not everyone, but they want some military action. A large number of people want the U.S. to get more involved. Haleh Amid, born in Iran in 1971, she left with her family when she was an infant. But now, reluctantly, she says, she has now come over to the side that believes American military might has to be used.
The Iranian regime is a state sponsor of terrorism. They have to stop supporting them. They have to close their embassies.
Do you want military action?
I personally say yes, but very targeted strikes.
And you can hear perhaps the reluctance in her voice. Another person here today, Farragut Forazan, says even though U.S. military action will bring additional deaths, the alternative, he says, is worse.
The lack of military intervention will cause another 16,500 people being massacred. So it's an ongoing issue with the Islamic Republic.
Now, many of these people we've spoken to in the past, they've been opposed to outside military action, but that's one of the things we have seen change in the last few weeks.
Steve, you say the people you've been meeting want a change in the leadership of Iran. Some say they want military action from the U.S. But what's the mood? I mean, do they think there's a realistic hope of regime change, especially given the suppression of protests?
Now, it depends who you talk to. Some of the people we've talked to are total believers. They think it's a matter of when, not if. They think the government could fall in the next few months. But there are many more who have a more uncertain view. Now, some of these people are longtime residents of Southern California. They've been here since the late 1970s when the Islamic government first took over, and they have had moments of hope in the past, only to see them dash. So these are people who are a bit more realistic, but they want it, but they're not sure it's going to happen.
Steve Futterman outside City Hall in Los Angeles. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Sarah.
Up to 1,500 active-duty U.S. troops in Alaska are on standby for deployment to Minnesota. This comes after President Trump threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act in the face of ongoing protests in Minneapolis. It's been a turbulent time in that city. Garrison Gibson, who came to the U.S. from Liberia as a child, got caught up in the chaos after heavily armed agents broke down his front door. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Garrison Gibson was home with his wife and school-aged daughter on a cold and quiet Sunday morning when a squad of masked men with rifles appeared at their house.
The knocking started around like 9 o'clock. We all was sleeping in the house. And it wasn't just like a soft knock. It was like a boom, 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 boom.
Gibson, speaking to reporters alongside his lawyer, says he refused to open the door and asked to see a warrant. A larger group of agents returned later. They did have an administrative warrant from the Department of Homeland Security to arrest Gibson in public, but they never got a federal judge's okay to enter the home. Soon protesters appeared banging drums. They recorded video as the men took a battering ram to Gibson's front door. Gibson's wife, Tiana Brown, also recorded video and asserted her rights as the men barged in. One is seen briefly leveling his rifle as another shines a flashlight in Brown's face.
Can you put the guns down? There's kids in this house. There is kids in this house. Show the warrant first. Show the warrant.
Agents handcuffed Gibson in his living room. They took him to a detention facility near Minneapolis and paused for what Gibson says was an act of ritual humiliation.
They took trophy pictures with their personal phones. Like, one stood by me on the right side of me, one stood on the left side of me, and they went like thumbs up.
A federal judge ordered ICE not to move Gibson away from his attorney and family, but the government flew him to Texas before acknowledging the error and returning him to Minnesota. ICE released Gibson 4 days later on the judge's order, but again detained him briefly on Friday at an immigration check-in. Attorney Mark Prokish says his client's immigration status is murky. He was handed a removal order in 2009 based on a now-expunged minor marijuana conviction. The government has allowed Gibson to stay in the U.S. provided he check in regularly. Prokish says Gibson followed the rules to a T.
We have the sheet that shows he goes in every 3 months or 6 months or whatever, and they say, okay, looks, is your address correct? Yes. Is your phone number correct? Yes. Have you done anything else bad? No. Okay, we'll see you again in 3 or 6 months.
In a statement, DHS calls Gibson a, quote, criminal illegal alien with a history of felonies, but did not provide any evidence. Court records show only misdemeanors from more than a decade ago. Gibson, who's 38, says he'll keep fighting to remain in Minnesota. He hasn't set foot in his native Liberia since his family fled a civil war there when he was six. After losing his job as a security guard, Gibson says his family is relying solely on his wife's income to pay their bills. That includes $700 to repair their front door after ICE illegally broke it down. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. Support for All Things Considered comes from Cromwell Solar. Since 1982, installing independent energy systems, such as backup batteries and solar panels for farms, homes, and businesses. More information is at cromwellsolar.com. And Kansas Tree Care. Winter dormancy is the ideal season for pruning mature trees, especially elms and oaks. More information at kansastreecare.com. or by calling 785-843-TREE. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a chance of flurries, mostly cloudy skies, a low of 10, wind chills as cold as zero, a high of 25 for Monday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Pentagon says up to 1,500 active-duty troops from Alaska are on standby for possible deployment to Minnesota, NPR has learned. This amid ongoing protests in Minneapolis over ICE agents in the city and the death of Renee Macklin Good. In a joint statement today, the 8 European nations that President Trump has threatened with tariffs over his desire to buy Greenland say they stand with the Kingdom of Denmark and the people of Greenland, saying that they're committed to upholding sovereignty. And at the weekend box office, James Cameron's Avatar: Fire and Ash took the top spot for the fifth straight weekend with an estimated $13.3 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Sarah McCammon. Women today are having far fewer children than just a couple of generations ago. One reason? Women now have many more opportunities than their grandmothers did.
I don't really feel like I got strong messages about what my life should look like beyond college graduation. I was very much under the impression that the world was kind of my oyster.
That's Caroline Brown of Charlotte, North Carolina. She's 33 and married, and like a growing number of younger women, she's unsure if she wants children.
She's not unusual. The birth rate now is about half of what it was in the 1960s. I wanted to understand how the choices available to women are shaping the choices that they make. So I recently met up with Caroline in Atlanta, where she was visiting her mother and grandmother.
Now, I don't know if we did a formal introduction. Sarah, this is my grandmother, Barbara Briscoe.
Yeah, your mother
introduces
that.
Thank you.
Barbara Briscoe, her daughter Cynthia Briscoe Brown, and Cynthia's daughter, Caroline Brown, make up three generations of women in the same family. They all had very different expectations around motherhood. Barbara is 93, and she told me that during her childbearing years, there wasn't a big question about what she was going to do with her life.
I think it was just accepted at that time that girls were going to grow up and be mothers. I mean, careers were not even discussed. So I don't think I ever thought anything except that I would be a mother.
She says there was a traditional model for what men and women did, and most people, including her, followed that script.
I was happy with it because it was all I knew.
Barbara had her children in the 1960s, a time when things were rapidly shifting for American women. Her daughter Cynthia, who's 65, remembers how she saw those messages changing as she was growing up.
I was part of a very transitional generation. In the early years, I think we were programmed to have very similar adult lives to our mothers. But as we got a little older, we began being told that we could have it all and that we should expect to have it all.
After college, Cynthia enrolled in law school, where she says roughly a fourth of her class was female.
And so the running joke was you had to be twice as good to get in if you were a woman.
And that pressure wasn't confined to school.
That's the story of my adult life, of being told that I could have everything, but then having to be twice as good just to stay even.
But even with more professional opportunities than her mother had, the idea of marriage and family life still appealed to Cynthia.
I don't know that I thought, you know, I'll have a girl and a boy or I'll have four kids. But yes, I think I always hoped that that would happen for me.
Cynthia met her husband, Jim, in college, and they did have a girl and a boy. Caroline, who we heard from earlier, was born just before her parents' first anniversary. Cynthia says being part of that transitional generation where women's lives were changing meant both she and her husband had to figure out how to be a team without a clear roadmap.
Just as I was working out my place as a woman in the world, and in society, men in my generation were having to do the same thing.
Even with Jim's support, Cynthia says balancing a demanding legal career with motherhood was difficult. She remembers trying an important case when Caroline was just a newborn.
I was not willing to tell local counsel that I had had a baby 6 weeks earlier, because I was afraid that he would think less of me as an attorney. And I remember thinking about that and saying, I can't admit that I can't do this.
She remembers secretly pumping breast milk during breaks in the trial. On one particular day, she frantically rushed to pick Caroline up after a long day in court.
And I walked in the door, and you were screaming because you were hungry. I was 2 hours late, 3 hours late getting back. And I remember in that moment thinking, is this really worth it?
For Caroline herself, having children has never felt like a high priority. She followed her parents' footsteps and went to Davidson College, where she now lives and works as a project manager in the food service industry. Caroline says her focus has been less on family life and more on getting an education and establishing a career.
I think as a millennial, the like follow your passion kind of messaging was really strong. I don't know that I really thought much about having a family later on. You know, I know some little girls dream of that, but I don't really remember thinking about it that much.
When she met the man, who's now her husband, Caroline says she wasn't necessarily looking for anything serious, and she felt it was important to be upfront about what she did and didn't want from a long-term relationship.
I made it a practice that by the third date, I found a way to work into casual conversation that I did not know if I wanted kids.
They were both on the same page, and they're both still uncertain.
I think it really comes down to neither of us have ever felt a strong pull to be parents. I think from our perspective, it doesn't really feel achievable to have it all like my parents did in today's world.
Caroline and her husband worry about the costs that come with raising a child, especially the cost of housing, and about the state of the world.
He is really concerned about where we're headed from a climate perspective and then also a societal perspective.
Her mom, Cynthia, says she hears that, but she says the world has always had its challenges in every generation.
We had Vietnam and the Cuban Missile Crisis and Watergate. 9/11 happened for them when she was the same age that my mother was at Pearl Harbor. So I think the idea that there's an ideal time to have a child and there's a perfect world to bring a child into is a fantasy and maybe a fallacy.
So much has changed since Barbara was born during the Great Depression. But she says when she looks at the choices her daughter and granddaughter have made, she's amazed.
Well, I'm very proud of both of them. I mean, I don't think it would be what I would have expected in a way. And I think they both have done what they wanted to do pretty much. Today, women have so many opportunities to decide whether they want children, don't want children, what they want to do.
Cynthia says she wants Caroline to make her own choices about having children, but that having Caroline in her life has been one of her greatest joys.
I would regret today not having had children. My relationship with them as adults has been a completely unanticipated delight and gift. And I can't imagine living without that richness.
Caroline is still thinking it all through, and she knows it's a big decision.
I expect that there's probably not a right or wrong answer to this question for us. I think it's just different lives. And I think in both versions, there will be moments where we regret the other possibility. And there'll be moments we're really glad we made the decision we did.
That was Caroline Brown talking with her mother, Cynthia Briscoe Brown, and her grandmother, Barbara Briscoe, at Cynthia's home in Atlanta. India and China are in a race to populate their long border in the Himalayas. The race began after China built hundreds of villages along the disputed border with India and paid people to move there. NPR's Amkar Handikar has been to the Indian side of the border.
The Nathang village is in a scenic valley of grazing yaks and glacial lakes, surrounded by the snow-capped Himalayas. This place in India's northeast is dotted with army camps, with slogans of military glory scrawled on their walls. There is a temple for a soldier who had died on patrol. His ghost is said to keep an eye over his fellow soldiers. Those who get drowsy on their watch, well, he smacks them awake. They need to be on their toes because this is a border region where Indian and Chinese soldiers have clashed, most recently in 2017. This is a report from News Channel Times Now at the time.
The troops, both sets of troops, in fact, just 50 meters away from each other. And as we understand, 3,000 troops on either side, which makes it a very tense situation.
But for residents, the bigger conflict is with nature. Winters here are harsh. Eggs and onions turn rock solid. There is no running water. The power goes off for days. And the internet? Forget about it. And that's why the village chief Sonam Bhutia felt seen when he heard a speech by India's finance minister Nirmala Sitharaman.
Border villages with sparse population, limited connectivity and infrastructure often get left out from the development gains.
She promised investment in hundreds of border villages under what she called
a new vibrant villages program.
The vibrant villages program.
The activities will include construction of village infrastructure, housing, tourist centers, road connectivity, and support for their livelihood generation.
That speech was in 2022. Since then, Chief Bhutia says all his village received is one solar-powered streetlight, and it broke down in a month. He accuses officials of corruption. That's why he says only a third of his village's population lived there, a total of 700 people. Similar migration across India's 2,100-mile border with China has emptied hundreds of villages. In contrast, Chinese state media says between 2018 and 2022, Beijing built at least 624 villages near the border areas. The combination of China's building spree and the emptying of India's border villages worry security analysts like Colonel Vinayak Bhatt. He has worked as a satellite analyst with the Indian Army. He says at least 10 of these Chinese-built villages are in the disputed areas.
They keep claiming, okay, these are civilians who have come in and occupied those areas. So if they have come in, what do? You can't kill them. So you have to have talks, and that they're taking advantage of.
Bhatt calls this the salami slicing tactic. He says that's why reviving India's border villages is crucial. But the progress so far has been, well, insufficient. Konchok Stanzin is a former Indian local legislator from the Himalayan territory of Ladakh. He says India doesn't plan its infrastructure projects the way the Chinese do. During a visit to the Indian village of Demchok a few years ago, he saw it himself, right across the border. He says when Chinese authorities build a road, they bring along power lines too. But in India, when they build a road, they dig it up for cables, then dig it up again for plumbing works. He says in the time it takes India to lay the groundwork for a project, China completes the project. India's Interior Ministry did not respond to NPR's requests for an interview. But Indra Hang Subba, a legislator from Sikkim, says the delays are often because of India's democratic system.
If China wants to do one thing, he will do it. You don't like it, you don't be there. But in India, we do things with the consensus of the people. So the pace obviously would be a little slower.
It's why, he says, it took 3 years to get work sanctioned for 40 projects in his Sikkim constituency, even though these projects would help India's national security. Even those residents who are returning wish the Indian state would hurry up. 3 years ago, Pema Sherpa quit her job in Delhi and returned to her hometown Kupup in Sikkim to look after her mother. The inadequate infrastructure, she says, is making her life frustrating.
Even my siblings, they don't prefer staying here because of issues like connectivity, network, internet. To want to people come here, work, establish themselves, I think these basics are needed.
Because Sherpa says, for most residents, their main challenge is not China. It's getting their own government to govern. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Nathan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Wearable sleep tech like smartwatches or rings that take real-time health metrics have made it super easy for the average snoozer to track their sleep from one night to the next. But is all that data giving you more rest or more stress? LifeKit reporter Andy Tagle investigates.
One of the first things that Dr. Ravi Isola often tells his patients is that insomnia, that is, trouble falling or staying asleep, is normal, at least from time to time. There's no need to fear the occasional bad slumber.
Whether you're particularly stressed or excited, perhaps, or anxious, what we want to avoid is a chronic pattern of insomnia. And I think that has significantly worsened in our society for a number of reasons.
Isola is a clinical professor of medicine and the director of the Center for Sleep Medicine at UCLA. Among some of the modern threats to our sleep, he says, over-caffeinating, irregular schedules, and the abundance of sensory input from our environments and our tech. And Isola, there's an increasingly common issue to add to that list, a condition called orthosomnia.
It's a huge problem. I think all sleep physicians have experienced this. A patient comes in and, well, what's the reason you're coming in today? Well, my tracker tells me I'm not getting enough XYZ sleep, you know, slow wave sleep or deep sleep or REM sleep.
Isola says sleep trackers, like the kind on your phone or Health Ring or smartwatch, can be very helpful for identifying patterns in your sleep, especially for people being treated for acute or chronic levels of insomnia. But they can also create a lot of sleep anxiety.
The fear that I'm not going to sleep, and what are the consequences of that going to be the next day? How am I going to perform? And that pattern is very activating to our nervous system. It sets us on kind of the high alert, fight or flight kind of path, and that's not compatible with sleep.
That kind of thinking can lead to a slow sleep score, can lead to staying in bed longer to try and force it, can lead to more stress, can lead to even less sleep, can quickly spiral into a pattern of insomnia. Trackers can make it easy for you to want to gamify or perfect your sleep. But
it's not something that has to be achieved. And especially personality types that are focused on, you know, fixing problems and, you know, coming up with solutions, that sometimes is a hard place to get to.
If you're set on tracking, Isola says make sure to have a set goal in mind. Maybe you're trying to get at least 7 hours every night, or you want to see how your new workout schedule is impacting your rest. Whatever you're aiming for, when you wake up each morning,
feel your body first.
As in, before you check your tracker, tune in. Are you energized? Or could you sleep for another 3 hours? Is your brain foggy and full of cobwebs? Or is that morning run calling your name? Don't let those sleep scores skew your memory.
This told me that I had a bad night last night, and I remember waking up X number of times and tossing and turning, and I feel terrible today. And the tracker kind of confirms that. I think that is meaningful information to at least tell you that this is matching up with how I feel.
To get the clearest picture, you'll want to log your data over a longer period of time, like weeks or months, not just days. And if you find your numbers aren't matching up with your experience on a consistent basis, you could consider talking to your doctor or just ditching your tracker, because you don't need tech to keep tabs on your sleep. Paper and a pen by your bedside work well too, and are actually standard practice in many insomnia treatment programs because they can help you focus on the feeling of your rest rather than the data. And Isola says, remember, that's the important part.
Persistent insomnia is not out of your control. The real goal is to try to take that power away from the devices and the things that drive our fear and anxiety and bring that power back internally, being able to self-regulate to allow sleep to happen.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagle.
This is NPR News.
5 years ago, a predominantly black church in Springfield, Massachusetts, named after Martin Luther King Jr., was burned down in a suspected hate crime. Now, on the first MLK Day since it reopened, church leaders say they're trying to focus on forgiveness and rebirth. That story in the next morning edition from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Available online anytime for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered here on a Sunday afternoon. KPR's Retro Cocktail Hour celebrates 30 years on the air with an anniversary weekend of live music, cocktail parties, and more on February 27th and 28th right here in Lawrence, Kansas. From live music by Nutty and Exotica Cocktail to mixology seminars and more. You can check out the full schedule and tickets over at kansaspublicradio.org. For tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a chance of flurries late this evening, skies cloudy, a low of 10 degrees with wind chills as cold as zero. Partly sunny for Monday and chilly temperatures with highs around 25, wind chills as cold as 4 below, and for Monday night partly cloudy with a low of 15. Should be sunny with highs in the mid-40s on Tuesday. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. In the early 2000s, the U.S. started investing millions, eventually becoming billions of dollars into fighting AIDS around the globe. The effort is credited with saving more than 25 million lives, largely through the distribution of life-saving drugs. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports on new research highlighting another benefit of those HIV drugs: drastically fewer orphans.
In the early days of Uganda's HIV epidemic, Dr. David Sarada traveled to the Rakai district in the rural south to investigate some of the earliest cases. As the epidemic grew in the late 80s and early 90s, the toll there was severe.
You could walk in households and you just have graves around households. There were households in Rakai that were actually headed by orphans.
Sarada recalls visiting what looked like an abandoned household in 1993.
We just kept shouting, "Is anybody home?" And then a young boy aged 9 and two children aged 6 and 7 came out. We asked where are the parents? The parents were gone.
That's likely because they died of AIDS. If you were a kid with an infected mother back then, you were 20 times more likely to be orphaned. Such orphans faced stigma, higher rates of school dropout, and mental health issues. Many ended up in poverty.
Some kids were just left with no parent and with no guardians to take them over. It was heartbreaking.
Today, the situation has become much, much better. The risk of kids becoming orphans because of HIV has plummeted. That's according to new research published in The Lancet Global Health by Sarada and his colleagues. The reason? Life-saving HIV drugs called antiretrovirals delivered primarily by U.S. foreign aid.
I'm about 70 years now. In public health, I've never seen a program intervention that has had this huge impact.
It seems obvious that giving parents with HIV life-saving drugs would mean fewer orphans. But to understand just how much of a difference they made, the team analyzed data on births, deaths, and HIV status among households in Rakai District from 1995 to 2002. They found the number of orphans declined dramatically from about 21% of kids to just 6%. Rachel Kidman is an epidemiologist at Stony Brook. She wasn't involved in the study.
The findings are just so clear. This decline in orphanhood is absolutely because adults have access to life-saving antiretroviral drugs.
Continued access to those drugs is now in question after the Trump administration's drastic cuts to foreign aid. Last year, many in Uganda couldn't get their HIV medicine, which they have to take every day, because the healthcare workers delivering them lost their funding. Kidman is concerned that could mean more HIV orphans.
I think the consequences for children are going to be very dire.
In a statement, the State Department told NPR that the U.S. continues to provide life-saving treatment for people with HIV. David Sarada says it's true partial funding has resumed for many programs.
But some programs just never started.
Over the next 5 years, the U.S. plans to shift responsibility for these programs to Uganda. That transition will be a massive challenge for the country, especially after the damage done to health systems by last year's cuts. But Sarada thinks their study reveals the stakes. Future generations of kids depend on pulling it off. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Here's an underdog story of the college football season you might have missed: Trinidad Chambliss's meteoric rise. A humble kid from Division II, Ferris State in Michigan, Chambliss transferred to the Division I, University of Mississippi, or Ole Miss as it's known, this season, and led his team to one victory short of competing in tomorrow night's National College Football Playoff. NPR's Jason Fuller explains.
Trinidad Chambliss is on his way up. He used recent changes to the NCAA's transfer eligibility rules to move to Ole Miss this season, and used his momentum on the field to make commercial hay, too.
Rumors of the apparent transfer of Trinidad Chambliss have been circling. The Ole Miss quarterback makes his decision coming up next.
An AT&T ad captured the excitement around the player and brought his face to America's screens. He wowed his coaches over the summer, and when chance presented itself early in the fall, Chambliss took over in dazzling fashion.
Chambliss retreating,
back near his own goal line. Picks up a block. Here we go again. Lacey, the catch.
And led his team to victory in the Sugar Bowl.
Chambliss lobbing it up behind the defense.
I think I'm just a gamer, you know. You got to make a play. I'm a playmaker as well, so, you know, I trust my guys to make the right decisions and make the right plays too.
That's Chambliss' reaction on ESPN after he threw a spectacular 40-yard pass.
He's the kind of guy that 1/100 of a second is going to make the right play because he's been trained to do that. You know, like mentally he believes, the team believes in him.
Tony Anise is the head coach for Ferris State University, where Trinidad Chambliss played before transferring to Ole Miss. Chambliss wasn't always the starting quarterback. Anise says Chambliss' mental resilience was a part of his success.
You cannot, like, be a superstar unless you're willing to grow when you're not the guy. You know what I mean? And he grew all the time. Like, every day he was trying to get better.
Old-fashioned hard work was something Chambliss was accustomed to.
I used to throw a baseball as hard as I could because he could catch it, and his hand-eye coordination was so advanced. If you were just driving by in a car, it'd be disturbing. You'd be like, why is that man throwing that ball that hard at that child, you know? I mean, what you couldn't hear is, throw it harder, Daddy. Throw it higher.
That's Trent Chambliss, Chambliss's dad.
Trinidad has a unique ability to galvanize people. It was evident when he was younger, playing outside, especially when he would be doing fun drills with his dad. The neighborhood kids would come around and there'd be 10 or 20 little kids just all doing what he did.
And that's Chambliss's mom, Cheryl Chambliss. The family is close and are open about their commitment to their faith. Their regular pregame prayer went viral on social media.
It encapsulates requesting and confessing that the Lord Jesus Christ is covering not just Trinidad, but the entire team with protection, with health, with clarity, and claiming success.
They leaned on faith all season, and they're leaning on it again as Trinidad Chambliss' football future takes a legal detour. Chambliss' attorneys are suing the NCAA after his appeal for an additional year of eligibility, they say lost to illness in 2022, was denied. Either way, his future is bright. Most NFL scouts project Chambliss as the third quarterback selected in this spring's draft. The legend of Trinidad Magic could become a Sunday special, but there's a chance he'll remain a Saturday night delight. Jason Fuller, NPR News.
Since the first sound film came out, Hollywood musicals have been an enduring movie genre and have given us some of our most iconic movie moments. Think Gene Kelly dancing in Singing in the Rain.
Just singing in the rain.
Or Judy Garland waking up in a magical land in The Wizard of Oz.
We're come to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is the wizard of wizards, ever a wizard there was.
And even as the movie musical has had its ups and downs since the heyday of the 1950s and 60s, it's still possible for them to capture the imagination of the public. Many movie fans love a good musical, while others may find them just a bit corny. Well, we have two such opposing viewpoints here in studio. NPR editor Barry Hardiman, a confessed musical fanatic.
Correct.
Hello.
Hello.
And Mark Rivers, a producer on All Things Considered and, I don't know, a skeptic,
not so much a fanatic.
Agnostic. All viewpoints welcome here. Barry, I'm going to start with you,
yes.
Though. So you agree with this description, musical fanatic, fair?
Absolutely. And I will say, you know, I am a theater kid. I was a musician. Like, you know, I was already attached to the genre before I ever saw it on the big screen. So for me, give me a musical. If you guys would like to start performing a musical, I would be in right
no,
now.
Thank you.
We could sing the rest of this.
The theater kid to public radio pipeline.
Yeah,
you know?
It's strong. So going strong.
What about you, Mark? Why not such a fan?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I grew up on more kind of stereotypically, I guess, boy content, like Star Wars, The Matrix, shoot 'em ups. You know, in my maturity, I now realize
which are all operas.
Star Wars is as goofy as a musical,
yeah.
But, you know, I just found something so kind of ridiculous about it. Like, why are you guys all of a sudden breaking into song? It felt like the music almost removed the stakes from the story. Like, even with something like Sound of Music, where there are literal Nazis, the sheer do-re-mi of it all.
Do-re-mi. Do-re-mi.
Just sap whatever stakes there are. and also if you look at some of these iconic movies, they're just so, just, you know, lily white ensembles and worlds. And, you know, I'm just thinking, well, why are these white people so happy singing like this? Like there are people riding in the streets outside. What? You shouldn't
Fair
be this
question,
happy.
Right?
So yeah, I just, as
no
a,
one's crying for you, Evita.
Right. Like you should be singing about Oliver at a time like this. Yeah. Like,
no, I hear you. Like it is a lot of sort of emotional whiplash sometimes from one moment to the next. And at the same time, the idea, when you think about it too long about bursting into song, is a little weird. I'm with you, Mark. I grew up in a very strict family where, like, a lot of movies, a lot of entertainment was off limits. But these sort of wholesome and, yes, admittedly, lily white because of the era when they were made. But some of these musicals, you know, from that era, like Sound of Music and Wizard of Oz, were seen as, like, wholesome and safe entertainment. You know, nobody was swearing. There was not really any real violence, or maybe the threat of it. Definitely not nudity. And so, like, this was, like, a safe thing that I could watch. And I think it was also a safe space to sort of explore a range of emotions, you know, and to sort of feel moved about things that you might not even as a kid understand.
Yeah.
And this reminds me, you choose points about kind of this expression of emotion. It reminds me of this English critic, Richard Dyers, who said that the movie musical, at least in American cinema, was kind of the fullest expression of like utopia, of utopian ideals. And you think about, you know, we're solving problems through music. We're solving problems through this idealized version of expression. And it's, and also the sense of like communal problem solving, right? Like it's not just
Let's
one
put
person.
On a show.
We're all breaking into song. We're all coming together in this moment. And there is something utopian about that, but it's often a false utopia.
What you're talking about, utopia is like quite a stylized place to be, right?
Right.
And that's when musicals really succeed, is when you are in a fantasy,
not quite
myth,
real
satire. Sometimes, like I think a dreamlike set. I mean, Chicago. This is like a totally like a vaudeville kind of a, you know, singing in the rain, like,
absolutely,
you know, Hollywood, this sort of joyful place where we can be, you know, show artifice, like,
and even taking these weighty themes sometimes, like Chicago,
and
dealing with them in like an accessible and almost innocent sounding way.
Yeah.
Right.
So I have to ask you, Mark, I mean, are there any musicals that you are a fan of?
So there are a couple. And I think the ones that I have taken to kind of deviate a little bit from this kind of wholesome vibe or wholesome kind of world. I'm thinking about Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet
Street.
You're
talking about Stephen Sondheim.
One of our great artists of the 20th century.
Where I feel like you and I can really
This is where we connect.
Vibe.
Yeah. And you know, this is about a kind of demented serial killer in England. But the music has such tonal range, you know, and in this version I'm thinking of from 2007, starring Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. You know, Johnny Depp brings this almost kind of punk rock energy to this movie.
All right, you, sir, have about a shave. Come and visit your good friend Sweeney.
It's a great tonal range to this film, but it is dark. It is brooding. You know, it does not bloody as all hell. It does not have the happy ending. But it's just wonderful sets, great acting, and there's a great variety of music in that film. Another one I think of is West Side Story. I'll take both. I'll take the one from the 60s and also Steven Spielberg's adaptation.
The remake, yeah.
Both of those films are about irreconcilable differences among class and race. You know, like, they're about like real issues, but they also embody what you're talking about, Barry and Sarah, just like expressing oneself fully, you know, through song.
Yeah.
And it's no wonder that a song like Somewhere, you know, becomes like an anthem.
There's a place for us, a time and place for us.
It can encompass and contain so many kind of feelings.
That's right.
And life experiences. West Side Story and Sweeney Todd. I could watch that anytime.
Same, I'll be there.
Barry, I know you're a musical lover, but like, what are your favorites? If you had to, you know, if you were
going to be here all day,
if you were stranded in
Gander, Barry,
if you were stranded in Gander,
do you guys want to go out and get something to eat? Well, I just like to list them. No, I like you, Sarah. I was also raised on the kind of the golden era movie musicals, and for me, Gigi, which guys has aged so badly, I totally get it.
Gigi. Am I a fool without a mind? Or have I merely been too blind to realize
But I want
so
it to be.
I want to, but I want to be honest about it because it's such a good example of why musicals can work. Music is just fabulous.
Dump it!
The night they invented champagne, it's plain as it can be. They thought of you and me. The night they invented champagne.
And because the music is so good, it elides the fact that this is a young woman who they are essentially selling
it's
into
great smoke
screen to be a courtesan.
Yeah.
So that's like one. But the other thing I like, what I really, really love is a political musical. I want to be inspired in, I want revolution. I will say that I think that the Kiss of the Spider Woman, which came out this year, is very, very successful in what it sets out to do.
I missed this one with Jennifer Lopez.
I think this one's made for you. Yes, okay. It is with Jennifer Lopez, who is like, she's turned up to 11, you know, because she gets to be a diva.
Come and find me, hear my song, let me hold you.
Basically about Argentinian revolutionaries in jail. It seems like it would be not so glamorous, but this is where the music, which is not actually even, like, I love the music. I don't think it's certainly not Sondheim, but it does such a good job of helping you be in the position of the prisoners and be beyond the prison itself, right?
Yeah.
Jennifer Lopez plays this diva who they're thinking about in this movie. Anyway, for me, that kind of political movie that is both about emotions, but is also like a little bit grittier, like give me some grit. I really do love that. That's why I don't mind a little blood. that for me is where it really gets successful.
That was NPR's Mark Rivers and Barry Hardiman. Good to have you both here.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
5, 6, 7, 8.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3, K210CR in Atchison, 89.9, and K258BT in Manhattan, 99.5. And always online, of course, at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday afternoon. Celebrate 30 years of music that's shaken, not stirred, when KPR presents the Retro Cocktail Hour's 30th Anniversary Weekend, February 27th and 28th. Join us for the Jet Setter Jazz of Nutty, plus Exotica Cocktail performing the music of Martin Denny and Les Baxter. For a complete schedule and tickets, visit kansaspublicradio.org. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Full Circle Sustainability in Topeka, offering recycling and composting services, package-free groceries, and locally grown food. More details at fullcirclesustainability.org. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
Sharif Homsi is a stand-up comic in a place that's not really known for its comedy scene, Damascus, Syria. As maybe you've heard, the place was run by a dictator for a long time, Bashar al-Assad. But back then, there were a lot of jokes that Sharif was not able to tell on stage. Definitely nothing about Assad or Assad's family. Nothing about politics at all. Those kind of jokes could get you killed or disappeared into one of Assad's infamous prisons. So during those years, Sharif kept jokes like that in a folder on his computer labeled Lebanon, because he pretty much only felt safe telling them when he would take trips abroad.
If there is one joke, well, I love this joke, I want to bring it back. But there is one joke I used to say when I go to Lebanon, like, listen, we have a lot of problem, but you don't have a president. And our problem is that we have one. So maybe if you take him and you can rent him for a bit, and if you like him, you can keep him. You know? You cannot say anything like this, man. That joke, if I say it over here, we will get killed. There is no joke with them.
Bashar al-Assad's family ruled Syria for 53 years, the last 13 of which were a brutal civil war. Over 300,000 Syrian civilians died. Then, a year ago, to everybody's surprise, a bunch of rebel groups overthrew the regime in just 12 days. Assad, his wife Asma, and their family flew to Russia. The rebels were led by an Islamist group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS for short. And then, the new people in power surprised everybody again by not immediately becoming another repressive regime. HTS leader Ahmad al-Sharaa says he's acting as interim president and has promised to hold elections in the next few years. And Syrians have been experiencing a freedom that they have not experienced before. I had dinner a couple weeks ago with somebody who was just there, and they were talking about how kind of inspiring it is to be there right now. She met lots of people who are moving back, ready and excited to rebuild their country. But at the same time, parts of Syria are still violent. There was fighting this month in and around Aleppo. Over 150,000 people were displaced. In July, Sharif had to cancel a show in a city called Suweida because of a massacre there. 800 people were killed. And then in October, in the middle of this chaos and hope, Sharif and the other comedians in his comedy group, the group is called Styria, decided to go on tour. They planned 16 cities in 21 days all over Syria, in conservative regions and liberal areas like Damascus, areas under Kurdish control, and areas that were once under ISIS control. And they really weren't sure how this was going to go. Nobody had ever done this. And this is the tricky part. Under the dictator, it was clear what they could not say on stage. But now, there seemed to be no rule book at all. If anything, the new government was saying, go ahead, you can make jokes about us. We're different from the old regime. But the comedians didn't know if they could trust that. And then beyond that, there are lots of just very conservative, very religious people around Syria. Some of them are figures of authority in towns and provinces. The comedians wondered how they would react to things that they heard on stage. They worried about random hotheads hearing about them and things they said, deciding to show up with a gun. Even before they left, they got death threats in their DMs. Stuff like,
if you ever talk about the revolution, we're going to come kill you one by one and blah, 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 blah.
These messages freaked Sharif out, but he got where they were coming from. The country's been through 13 years of war. Yeah, most of the other comedians are from Damascus, a city that saw the least of the fighting because it was controlled by the regime. By Syrian standards, they're the soft liberals.
I understand because some people, man, they see what we do as a luxury. My house was destroyed, and my brother was dead, my mother was dead, and you here in Damascus were having fun. You didn't have anything wrong, and you're going to make people laugh. This is like luxury, you know. So they cannot take the joke, and I understand. They have the right to be sad.
Any comedy show in Syria right now, for everybody, comedians, the audience, they're all figuring out what's okay to say out loud. Eamon Ogana, a reporter based in Damascus, heard about all this. And he also was very curious to see what the comedians could get away with and whether they would even get all the way through the tour. He hung out with them on tour for 2 weeks, on long van rides across Syria, backstage at their shows. Lots of stuff ended up happening. Stuff, I think it's safe to say, they did not see coming. From WBEZ Chicago, This is American Life, I'm Ira Glass. We hit the road with these comedians today. And with that introduction, here's Eamon with Act One, an act we're calling Too Soon.
I meet up with the comedians in Safita, a city about 3 hours' drive north of Damascus. They're in a shared apartment that doubles as a green room. The venue owner let them all crash for free. There are several mattresses to a room, suitcases under the beds, and the comics are walking in and out of rooms, getting ready and telling jokes to warm up.
Hello. I need to get naked. No.
Maliki is Maliki Mardin Ali, one of the founders of the group, along with Sharif.
He can ask him anything, where he's dressing.
Okay, Maliki, while you're dressing, I'm going to ask you the same question I just asked Sharif.
Is there a joke you're thinking of saying tonight that you're not sure if you want to say it, that might be a bit dangerous?
Actually, there was a few, but a few minutes ago we were speaking about it. I feel if I say something on the government, it would be a little bit dangerous. They will not feel comfortable, you know, something like this. For the sensitivity of this place, not because we can't say it, you know. But here I don't know how they will react to it.
And what is the joke you're not sure about telling?
Maybe something about how the Ministry of Defense dress. They don't wear shoes. They only wear the flip-flops, you know. That's how they fight. I feel something like this. It's a lot dangerous to see someone feet in a war, you know.
This is actually a joke about the current government, that there are such a ragtag army that they came to power in flip-flops. Comedy and poetry are probably the hardest things to translate from any language.
I swear to God, in Arabic, it's very funny. Okay. Just anyone is hearing us right now, it is funny in Arabic. You should learn Arabic and come and watch the show.
Maliki plays it safe that night in Safita. He skips the flip-flop joke. Styria is a small crew, around 20 comics. Two of them are women. Some still keep their day jobs. There's a dentist, a university lecturer, an engineer, students. They are mostly in their 20s and 30s. The group's name, Styria, is a combination of Syria plus hysteria, because that's what it felt like to laugh in Syria when the group got together 3 years ago. A manic release. Sharif and Maliki do this full time. Sharif is the group's spiritual leader, the one who used to have a folder labeled Lebanon. He's got a laid-back stoner vibe, covered in tattoos, light beard, 33 years old. Maliki is the one running the tour. He's 29 years old, with dark hair and a cheeky grin. He's the Paul McCartney to Sharif's John Lennon, more tightly wound. He's the fixer, lining up venues, negotiating with government officials, driving the van, keeping track of permits, schedules, and constantly updating the list of things that could go wrong. He worries out loud, cracks jokes as he does it, a kind of nervous humor that makes it clear he's holding the whole operation together. He actually thinks they're going to be fine on this tour.
I don't think something bad will happen to us. Because nobody cares about it. Let's state the obvious. Nobody cares about who the we are. I'm not like a superstar. I'm not George Clooney on the tour. Well, Melky, he's Sharif, that's Khaled, that's Aziz. Nobody cares about us. Nothing bad will happen to us. A few people telling some jokes. Let them.
But there are two stops on the tour he's worried about.
I'm most scared of is Aleppo and Hama. Aleppo and Hama, those two cities are very dangerous. Very dangerous. Oof, man. Oof. So we have to be careful dealing with, the mind on the, I don't know what it's the term, Al-Gham, Haqqal Al-Gham.
Minefield.
Minefield, yes. So it's a minefield in Hama.
Hama is a conservative city, stop 7 on the tour. Aleppo is stop 9, a city divided by different factions. Before they could go on the tour, Maliki had to sign what he translates as an obligation with the Ministry of Tourism, a pledge to avoid certain jokes. Unlike during the old Assad regime, they're allowed to make fun of the current leaders. The pledge is a promise not to use hate speech, and to avoid jokes that could rile people up and cause civil unrest, like jokes about religion. It's a written commitment tied to the permit. If they breach it, the Ministry of Tourism can cancel the show or penalize the group. The first 4 shows go pretty smoothly, playing in mostly liberal towns where they didn't expect problems. One gets oversold because the app they use to sell tickets malfunctions, which is a huge pain in the ass. But mostly, it's sold out rooms. So far, so good. Stop 5 on the tour, Latakia, a sunny port city with a beachfront and blue Mediterranean waters. Fish restaurants and clubs line the shore. It's been called the Miami of Syria. And it would be, except for what happened here last March, when sectarian violence killed around 1,500 people. That's the stage the comedians are walking into tonight. Fun, but tense.
Okay, it's Wednesday the 15th of October. We're in Latakia. We're just arriving at the venue to see Sharif, Maliki, and the guys as they set up. It's a beautiful venue overlooking the sea.
My friend, hello, welcome, welcome.
Hi, everyone. Hi, how are you?
What's happening?
We're preparing for the show.
Sharif is unloading equipment and making sure everything is in place, working. Maliki's putting up posters and banners at the entrance.
So we're preparing the show, and we just learned we cannot do our show in Hama.
Hama, one of the cities Maliki was worried about.
Man, this is insane. This is insane. This is crazy.
Oh. You're pissed off.
Yeah, very, very, man. Very angry about it.
They had gotten a call from their fixer in Hama, the guy setting up their show there. He said he had gone to pay the fees for the show, but was told the local government in Hama wasn't going to allow it.
Because we got a report that we are... this is a new one. Prepared.
It's fresh.
It's a fresh. We are supporting the gay rights in Syria or in Hama.
Why?
We don't know. Like, the one who's preparing the venue in Hama, they send him to the...
They are assuming. We didn't say anything about this kind of topic. Ever.
Like, Maliki talk to the guy in the government, tell him, bro, like, this is really offensive. Like, if you tell me I'm threatening the people, the religion, anything, I'm talking against politics, I understand. But gay rights, why? Like, when? You don't see? So we don't know
how, who?
Why?
Too much W. Yeah,
like, the Styria comedians can talk about whatever they want in their sets. Their only rule is no hate speech. But still, nobody campaigns for any rights of any kind in their shows.
Listen, imagine, like, you cannot think about supporting any rights, like you see, gay right, vegetarian right, any right. So the idea, we don't know much.
They care about Hama because it's symbolic. A full house in a town with a conservative reputation. A real test of what they can or can't say in the new Syria. They weren't even going to play Hama when they planned the tour. Too conservative, too many ways it could go wrong. But then a fan of the group DM Sharif, begging him to come. We like you here. We want you here. We want to change the conservative stereotype of our city. So Sharif said, okay, let's do Hama. They figured if they could play Hama, it could open the doors to other conservative cities too. And they sold out the Hama show, 230 tickets. It's Wednesday. The Hama show is supposed to happen Monday, so Maliki calls the guy in charge of culture in Hama, a local bureaucrat he calls the Sheikh, to convince the Sheikh to not cancel the show.
I am beyond worried right now. My mind in Hama.
That night, they still have a show to do. It's a simple format. 6 comedians, 7 minutes each. The room is full. Maybe 200-300 people. Maliki opens the show. He asks the audience not to take videos or photos or post on social media because they just got in trouble with the government for promoting homosexuality.
اليوم أكلنا تقرير دعم للمسلمين.
Maliki tells a version of the flip-flop joke, how security forces have been fighting for 14 years but keep their toes out. It gets a big laugh. Then he hands the mic over to Sharif. Sharif tells a joke that definitely would have gotten him into trouble under the Assad regime. It shows you how much things have changed in Syria this last year. It's about Asma al-Assad, the dictator's wife, who had breast cancer. Technically, it's about her bra. Here's the setup. December 8th, 2024. The Assads flee for Russia. Syrians go to the abandoned presidential palace to loot it, taking little trophies, souvenirs.
So in that joke, I say people went to Bashar al-Assad to steal some watches, some expensive painting,
Me, I go what I get. Asma al-Assad, brah.
Sutyanet, Asma al-Assad.
And I have it one piece.
He holds up half of a bra. The other half is missing.
Because she got one taken because she had cancer. And people start to laugh and feel shy. And I say, don't feel sorry about her. She has cancer. Feel sorry for the cancer he have. Asma al-Assad. And people say, like, oh. I love the joke.
Biggest laugh of the night. Afterwards, I talked to a few members of the audience.
How was the show tonight?
Tremendous. Extraordinary. I haven't witnessed anything the same in my life.
It was amazing. It was unbelievable. It's a... no one expected this. They say things that that you cannot say, especially in Latakia. They're amazing.
The only criticism I heard was that they were not political enough.
I would like to hear more about politics, because the more you talk about the about politics, the more you are free. I don't think that in the coming years they will be able to mention the same jokes. I don't believe that they are going to be free like this. I feel that Syria now is going to be like the Assad period.
Some Syrians have told me that they feel as though they're speaking on borrowed time. They're happy the old regime is gone, but are unsure about the future. Syrians are setting precedents for what can be said, post by post, room by room. But maybe it's a bubble. They can joke for now, but there's real trepidation about what comes next. By the end of the night, the comedians haven't heard back from the Sheikh. The fate of the Hammer show is still on the line.
Coming up, the comedians head into Hama province, the Sheikh's province, and the Sheikh brings all the boys to the yard. Figuratively, I mean. Stay with us.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporia, and always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday evening. KPR continues to expand its news coverage because of support from more than 6,000 listeners just like you. In-depth reporting matters so much to our members that they're willing to spend 10 or 20 or even more every month to ensure the service continues to grow. Their support matters, and so does yours. Take a minute and go to kansaspublicradio.org to donate today. Thank you for your support of KPR. A chance of flurries tonight in northeast and east central Kansas. A low of 10 degrees, wind chills between 0 and 5. Partly sunny for Monday with a high of 25. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This American Life. If you just tuned in, reporter Eamon O'Gana hit the road with a group of Syrian comedians on their first nationwide tour since the Assad regime fell a year ago. We have arrived at Act 2, the drama in Hama. Here's Eamon.
The comedians have a two-day break after Latakia, so they go back to Damascus to recuperate. They still don't know what's going to happen with their show in Hama. I meet up with them at Sharif's place in Damascus, his family's house. It's big, in a nice leafy neighborhood.
How are you feeling?
Oh, tired. I need massage, Eamon.
We step into Sharif's bedroom, the operating base for Styria. Maliki, Sharif, and Omar, another founding comedian, have all kicked off their shoes and are drinking coffee and discussing what's to come. They are waiting for the Sheikh to call with an update on Hama. Maliki's phone stays face up on the table. Psychedelic stoner posters are taped to the wall. A desktop computer obscures the window. A few childish pictures sit on the mantel. Maliki points to them. A Harry Potter poster and a painting made by a small child.
That's from Karim al-Assad room, the Sons of Bashar.
Oh, wow. So this is taken from the palace?
Yes. Yeah.
And I have few stuff also from his house. What we get also, Milky, I get from his house, I took stuff, yani, not something with its value to me more than its value in the real world, you know, because that day was magnificent, man. Yeah, yeah. I say this in my stand-up. I said, I really hope we don't have to feel this feeling again. of us getting liberated, because in order to feel it again, another dictator would have to come. So in that day, I felt totally free. It was total chaos, man. Like, I spent from 6 o'clock until 6 at the evening, I was outside in the road with my friend celebrating. We went to Al-Assad home. You see, I have his bra, his painting and stuff. We went to the parliament, to the Ministry of Defense. His wife...
So that's really his wife's bra? Yeah, You're not kidding?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. I brought stuff for me. I have... And the half of the bra, I give it to my girlfriend, my ex-girlfriend, because...
I thought you were joking.
That's no, man. It's a real... I turn it into a joke. Let me show you. Let me show you the book of my stand-up comedy. When I was inside, let's see.
When Sharif says he was inside, he means prison. Sharif was jailed in Dubai for a little more than 3 years, from 2018 to 2021. He hands me a paperback book with a worn cover.
So this was with me in the inside. See what I write?
Be a Great Stand-Up is the name of the book. Oh, wow, it's covered in handwritten notes. Yeah. This is your notes?
This is my notes. This is me writing stand-up in the inside.
So you're inside your cell, just reading about comedy and writing in this book?
Yeah. Yeah, I can show you... I can show you a book where I write what I want to do when I'm going to go out.
So this is a notepad you had in prison?
Yeah. And you can see in English, I say new laptop, writing, and stand-up comedy. And I read here some gem, Never Never Speak the Plan.
What's Never Never Speak the Plan?
I used to talk a lot, man. This is what got me into...
This is a narcotics charge. Sharif was dealing drugs in Dubai and got caught by the authorities.
I got greedy and I got caught by a kameen, by an ambush. And they gave me marked money. And it was all a play, yani, all a game. I was the one who burned.
According to court documents, Sharif sold drugs to an undercover cop. A snitch had tipped off the police. He was arrested and given a life sentence, which, in the UAE, is a common penalty for drug offences, no matter how small. He says he got out because his father wrote a mercy petition, a letter to the prosecutor, begging to let him go.
My name was 71. It was 70 people who meant to go out. And they added my name after 3 years and 3 months. And
thank God. And then you came out and you were like, I know what I want to do. I'm going to be a comedian.
Actually, the first year I was an animal.
What do you mean?
You know, you're basic. I want to eat. I want to have sex. I want to hear some music. It was taken from me. And after 9 months, I was going into them. It's the same cycle that get me into jail.
A friend called him out for how he was acting. Sharif said enough and broke the cycle by focusing on saving money for his comedy dream, taking any job he could.
And when that happened, everything started to happen. Like, someone asked me to do stand-up comedy between parties and stuff, and I was like, I will not do this. And I thought, is it possible in all Syria and all the dark humor and we have, I am the only one in Syria or Damascus that want to do stand-up comedy. Just let me put the news out and see who are interested. Like, I needed a team so I can start, so we can do something, yani.
That's how he met Maliki. They both grew up in Damascus. Sharif is Muslim, Maliki is Christian. They had mutual friends but didn't know each other. Maliki was working in a bank at the time. But they both dreamt of being stand-up comedians. Here's Sharif.
Someone sent me his Facebook and I went to research his Facebook. He had some bad content on Q Media. Then I find him start to do stand-up comedy. He tried in 2020 alone.
How do you start to do stand-up comedy on your own?
I don't know.
You just got up in the bar and were
actually, this is a very good one. I don't know if I told the guys of it. Kamal, my friend, we were having a drink in Mad Monkey Pop. So we were talking and I don't know. I'm just saying stories and something like this. He started to laugh very hard. So he called Bisan, the owner of the place, and told her that I should start doing stand-up comedy at her venues. She refused it, of course.
But then, a week or so later, the owner of the bar changed her mind. Maliki's friend called and told him.
And that was just because you were like a funny guy and people thought you...
That's it. I don't know shit about stand-up at that time. Like, I'm coming from NGOs and bank. Background, you know.
So you worked in a bank, but you told jokes to your friends, and your friends were like,
yes. Most of my jokes come from that. I'm a good roaster at I was at the bank. So,
and how did it go at Mad Monkey? Your first
man, it's pure. It's the purest you will ever see in your life.
Did people laugh?
The people were sick. Not laugh. They told Bisan, come on, turn the music on, man.
Maliki had decided to quit the bank, tired of counting other people's money. And out of the blue, Sharif called him to invite him to a stand-up workshop he was hosting.
At the same day, man, at the same day, 2 p.m., I signed that paper. 4 p.m., Sharif called me. And at the same day.
And I remember when I called, he said, I cannot come at this time.
This is the Sheikh.
Oh, the Sheikh is calling Maliki now.
Hello. Hello, Astazi, hello.
Maliki answers the phone. Sharif paces the room, smoking and listening carefully. The call lasts about 15 minutes.
Allah yajzik al khair, ya Rab. Shukran ila. Shukran ila. Ala rasi, shukran ila. Hello. Oh my God.
So what just happened, Maliki?
Oh my God, man, this is insane. This is insane. 15 minutes on the phone just to talk, just to say that you are not allowed to do your stand-up in Hama. Okay? After this call, he will reconsider the things. Yani.
What the Sheikh said in the call was that he didn't know who cancelled the show, but he understood why someone would cancel it. He'd actually seen their set in Mojade a few months back, and he thought some of the content was inappropriate, and certainly it would be for Hammer, but not because of anything to do with LGBTQ material.
So what were the kind of things he was saying to you?
Man, this is insane. He told me that you can't say your material in Hammer because it's offensive to the family values. Because we are talking about our parents. So he felt that, they are breaking the bonds between the families. They are affecting the people that who watch this kind of shows. That we are a threat. That's how we are a threat to the family. You know, we are a threat to the family value. This is much more insane than the LGBTQ support thing, yeah. Man. This is really new, man. This is really new. All of us have jokes on our parents, man. Everybody. This is insane. It's my dad, man. It's my dad. If I can't speak on my dad, what should I speak? For what should I speak? This is my family. This is my culture. This is, we are doing stand-up comedy for the Sheikh. Not for the people. You know, this is how things are now going.
Yeah.
The first 3 months, we had freedom.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Oof. Amazing. Oof. It's like coming from dark to the light. Then we are slowly closing the window. Now slowly closing the door. Slowly closing the curtains. This is bad. This is bad. Oh, here we go again. You know? Oh, here we go, another Assad regime.
On the call, Maliki told the Sheikh they wanted to perform in Hama, to show that Hama isn't just some strict and conservative city where nothing happens. The Sheikh said he'd look into it and get back to them with a final answer soon.
So he's going to call back in a few hours with his decision.
I think he will call the brothers.
The brothers is Malik's sardonic way of referring to the Islamist officials now running things.
They will call the brotherhood. He will call them and will have their advice.
The next day we hit the road again. Piling into a bright yellow van with stickers lining the sides saying Styria in the font of Grand Theft Auto. Maliki is driving. Sharif sits behind him. There's so much equipment in the back that Maliki can't see out the rear window. It's about 3 hours to Salamia. Stop 6 on the tour. depending on checkpoints.
What's the latest with the Sharif?
Sharif sent me a screenshot that he is pushing also in Muharde.
To stop you?
Yes.
Muharde is the show tomorrow night. The Sheikh is now saying that show might be cancelled as well.
And what's your strategy with the Sheikh? How are you going to convince him or control him or influence him?
He's going to turn to Islam.
You're going to convert to Islam?
I hope I don't have to. Because if the Sheikh didn't kill me, my parents will. So I'm dead either here or there.
Told him we will not stop. So if they want to stop, let them stop us, khalas. If it's gonna go to jail, please take me to jail, bro. I miss it.
And with all this drama, do you want to perform in Hama?
Yes. Our show is sold out in Hama. Man, there is 200 people right now. The only entertainment they have here is us. So far, beside killing each other, you know? So, we are a must, not a need.
A few minutes later, still on the road to Salamia, Maliki gets a text.
The Sheikh just texted me that not going to be a show in Hama. This is final decision.
So what are you going to do?
We're going to tell the people in Hama to come to our show in Muharde.
Are you going to tell them why?
Yes, of course, I'm going to tell them why.
For them, this isn't over. They could let it go, but Maliki won't. They decide to test the limits another way, make it public, and see who's stronger right now, the government or the people. They want to use public opinion to force them to reinstate the show. The Styria comedians are all pretty young. They think in TikTok and Instagram. They believe a big enough online following will give them protection from government officials trying to silence them. They have hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram. Syria's revolutionaries also use social media to rise to power. But now that they run things, they fear it. Fear posts that inflame sectarian tempers. Fear looking weak. At the same time, they don't want to look like the old regime, repressive and censoring in public. So they pressure quietly, in private, and the comedians answer loudly, online. Maliki and Sharif go on the offensive. They post that the Hama show is cancelled and tell Hama fans to come to Muharde instead. They'll add seats, they'll arrange buses. They're trying to turn the followers into force. It's a respectful post, not calling anyone out, but they figure their fans will understand why it was cancelled, get pissed off, and put pressure on the government. But then, one of the other comedians, Abu Aziz, goes rogue on his personal Instagram account.
So, Abu Aziz, you know him. Abu Aziz is much crazy. He's not diplomatic, you know? He's not diplomatic. He very, very stupid and very...
very Abu Aziz,
you know?
On Instagram, Abu Aziz goes off. He rants about the Secretariat for Political Affairs in Hama, says they accuse the troop of LGBTQ content and of being a threat to family values. He blames them for cancelling Hama. We're back to how we were before, he says, which sounds pretty mild, but he's comparing the new government to the old regime, which is dangerous. Abu Aziz has nearly 300,000 followers. Him posting online left some in the group nervous, but excited Maliki and Sharif. The comments start right away, angry at the government. Word gets back. Someone from Political Affairs calls Abu Aziz. Political Affairs also contacts the Sheikh. The Sheikh calls Maliki. Maliki doesn't pick up, so the Sheikh follows with the text.
I didn't answer the same. I will let him. Khalas, we have cancelled this show. But then when...
in an hour, answer him. In an hour, answer him.
I think I will tell... No, leave him in half an hour. Let things boil up, you know? So leave him now. I think an hour later, or maybe in the evening, they will tell us, do your show in Hama.
Some members of the group are worried by the strategy, wishing they had been consulted first. But almost as quickly as they stir up the online storm, Sharif gets a text from the Hammer venue owner. No matter what, he won't let them use the venue. It's not worth it to him. He's scared of a visit from the authorities, a fine, a lost license, a knock at the door, or worse, an attack. Maliki and Sharif have officially lost the battle for Hammer. They're still trying to direct people to come to the Mahade show instead, but now that might be cancelled as well. They play Salamiya that night.
Marhaba Salamiya.
Wow.
Hey.
It goes great. Standing ovation. Then, after the show, a call from the Ministry of Media. This guy is furious about Abu Aziz's post and tries to stop the show they've just finished.
But are you worried they're going to stop your other shows?
No. Tomorrow it's going to be Mharde. No, they are not going to come to Mharde. Maybe they will do some phone calls and that's it. It's now our move. On the chessboard, it's now our move. We have the media. We have the people.
Yeah.
They have weapons. Yes.
So Abu Aziz is very powerful chess piece.
No, he is very tahash, we call it that. The one who, like a tank, you know? This is the first to come into the battle.
Okay.
And then people come like snipers and military. And everything is a war. Yeah, in Syria, everything is a war. Even the art is a war. You know?
Maliki isn't worried about the show in Mahade. He tells me, it's a Christian town, so the Sheikh has no power there.
Eamon O'Gama. Coming up, Muharda, she wrote. The comedy show moves on to Muharda. That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio when our program continues.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us here on a Sunday evening. We invite you to celebrate 30 years of music that's shaken, not stirred, when KPR presents the Retro Cocktail Hour's 30th Anniversary Weekend on February 27th and 28th. Join us for the Jet Setter Jazz of Nutty plus Exotica Cocktail, performing the music of Martin Denny and Les Baxter. For a complete schedule and tickets, just visit kansaspublicradio.org. Tonight in northeast and east central Kansas, a chance of flurries, mostly cloudy skies, a low of 10, with wind chills between 0 and 5. For Monday, partly sunny with highs in the mid-20s. You're listening to Kansas Public Radio.
This American Life, Myra Glass. Today's show, a Christian and a Muslim walk into a bar. We pick up with a reporter, Eamon O'Gama, and the comedians of Styria on their tour of the country for Act 3, an act we're calling. Is this thing on?
It's morning. We're back in the van, heading from Salamiya to Mahardi, a show they hope will still happen, and where a busload of fans from Hammer will join them. We pass a car with a rocket launcher on the roof.
This is a rocket launcher, man.
On a Humvee.
Monuments of Syria's bloody war still dot the roads. We see bombed-out buildings and burnt-out cars on the way. We have a system for checkpoints. Maliki flashes a big smile, and I hide my recording equipment under a coat.
Checkpoints.
Okay, checkpoint. I need to take my headphones off.
Maliki is flying high this morning. We're leaving the more conservative Sunni Muslim areas and heading to a Christian town. Christians are a minority in Syria, about 10% before the war, and Maliki is Christian. He's relaxed, in shorts, grinning as he drives.
This is Mahardi?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is Mahardi. Welcome to the Christian people! F*** you, Sharif.
I'm with you, yeah.
F***. Hallelujah! Hallelujah! Now we are safe. Now we are safe from HDS and all the governments. This is a Christian country. Here, this is a Christian land. No Muslim is allowed to go here. Ayman, are you Christian?
I am.
Yes, welcome home.
We get into town, go into a cafe.
Maliki,
yeah.
Have you heard from anyone who's from Hammer, who's taking the bus tonight?
I don't know, but I think there's 40, 50 people, something like this. I feel that when the evening come, it would be 60 or I think 60, 70, something like this. I hope it's going to be good. This is where we drink a lot. And this is the place. They are very, very, very generous. Very generous here. Because they are Christian.
Everyone is happy, smiling. They order pizza.
I go back to us. I love this song.
But an hour later, the mood changes. Maliki looks distressed. He has changed back into jeans, as conservative Syrians frown upon men wearing shorts. We get back into the car with the venue owner for the show tonight.
Okay, Maliki, tell me exactly what's happening.
Oh, a lot. Happening a lot. Let me think about it first, then I will talk to you. Just to...
The venue owner has gotten a call from the local government in Mahade, asking him to come in for a meeting. We drive to the local municipal building. I walk with Maliki, but get stopped at the stairwell, while Maliki and the venue owner go into an office. A few minutes later, Maliki comes back and says I can come in.
Please give it to the boys outside.
Give what, the recording?
Yes, the recording and the headset.
Okay,
and
sure. I can listen.
And your bag also.
Okay.
They take my bag, the recorder, everyone's phones. There are two government men inside the office, beards, shaved moustaches, military outfits. They look straight out of central casting. But they're polite. One asks if we want coffee. Another then brings glass cups of Nescafe 3-in-1, a sugary instant coffee ubiquitous across the Middle East. My translator waits downstairs, so I don't follow everything, but one of the government guys says he recognizes me. I'd covered the Syrian war, and we had been in the same towns in Idlib province. Maliki later jokes that 10 years ago they may have kidnapped me. It's a different country to report in now. I watch the room. The older one sits behind a desk, does most of the talking. Eventually, another brings in a piece of paper and beckons the venue owner to come to him. The owner is nervous and doesn't hesitate to sign it. Maliki explained to me what was going on afterwards. First,
they were very angry. So they told us that we can't do our show in Mahade because there is no permission from Hama, political affairs. So now we are making some phone calls to have that permission. I hope to have it, yani.
Maliki had miscalculated. He figured that because Mahade is a Christian town, the Sheikh and the local Hama government wouldn't have reach here. But instead, the local politicians in Mahade are telling them, if they want to do tonight's show in Mahade, they need to get permission from the Sheikh and the other bureaucrats in Hama, the ones they started a battle with yesterday, the ones now threatening a libel case.
What was it they made the owner sign?
Obligation.
Saying...
He promises that he won't let us do the show without a written permission from their office.
Has this ever happened before to you?
No. No.
When you arrived in Mahade, you were like, we're free now, no one can stop us. So how do you feel now?
They have more power than I thought here. This is dangerous. Yesterday, they were very upset with us doing the show in Salami. So now they will prevent us from doing the show here. I don't know what things would happen the next few hours.
Their only path tonight is persistence. If they can get permission from the Hama officials Abu Aziz just insulted, they can still go on in Mahade. It's 3:15 p.m. The show is at 7. It's sold out. Buses of fans are supposed to come from Hama. We get in the car, me, Maliki, and the venue owner, and head towards Hama to try to talk to the politicians and see if there's any way to save tonight's show in Mahade. 10 minutes out, the venue owner answers his phone. I can't tell what the call is about, but he goes quiet, then asks us to turn back. We head back to Mahade, to the same cafe. Maliki smokes a cigarette on the street outside, defeated.
Why did we turn back from Hama?
Because they started to hurt him now. They started to hurt him. I'm sorry, man, I have to stop this because I'm very tired now.
Maliki later told me that the venue owner got a call from his dad. The government is also putting pressure on him, real enough pressure that he got scared and didn't want to cause more trouble by heading to Hama. To make matters worse, on the way back, Maliki also gets a call. First, they've been told they needed permission from the political affairs office in Hama to run the Mahadeh show. Now the bar moves even farther away from them. Officials are now saying they need three permissions, from political affairs and also from the ministries of tourism and culture. And the guy running the local office of the Ministry of Culture is the Sheikh.
This is because of jokes. Yes. This is because of jokes. I can't think of a place than here. No? I hate this country, I swear to God. I hate it from the bottom of my heart. No, this is a message that you don't play with us.
They think you're troublemakers.
Yes, yes, for them. This is insane. This is insane.
What's up,
Captain? I'm tired now. Mentally and physically tired. I'm using all my connections. And when I do, when I put 9 on the table, they put 10. I put in a guy, they put a queen. I put the king, they put an ace. So it's always... We're going to wait 1 more hour and then we will... know what to do. We need an hour, I think. Man, I don't know what to do. I don't want to be a fight. I want to be an agreement.
Well, you want to be a comedian, and you can't do that.
This is the last thing I think of right now, Maxim. I swear to God, this is the last thing I think of.
Maliki hasn't eaten since yesterday. He's running on coffee and cigarettes. He's getting impatient with my questions. He and the other comedians start talking in Arabic around a crowded table. The conversation is heated. I find Sharif outside the cafe, emotional.
Okay, man, I can see you have tears in your eyes. You're upset.
Wallah, ya bro. I feel sad, you know?
Why?
I'm sad because the people who got influence now, they're using Bashar ways to, and Bashar law to stop us from making people have some fun.
Yeah, how is freedom of expression working out for you in Syria now?
It's not working. Like, at all. Like, it's not working and the thing are working as not freedom, or who have the bigger balls.
How are the other guys taking the news?
Some of them are scared. Some of them, Qasim, imagine, he's scared. He's a doctor in the university. He's scared that might reach him in a way that they will let him go from the university. Other wanna make money, other wanna make fame, other wanna make the project continue. It's their own right to feel and do whatever they want. But for me, I push by myself. Yeah. So, let's see.
But soon after this conversation, they call it. Maliki can't secure the three permissions in time, so they're forced to cancel just 3 hours before showtime. They post on Styria's Instagram that the show's off due to unforeseen circumstances and tell people they'll refund tickets. Now they're worried the government is also going to cancel their show in Aleppo, which is 2 days away. I find them hours later in Sharif's hotel room. One of the other comedians is giving Sharif a massage.
So I see you guys are promoting LGBTQ.
That night, instead of doing their show, they get drunk and dance until 3 in the morning. The next day, the politicians in Hama want Abu Aziz to bend the knee, apologize. Maliki says he won't make Abu Aziz do that alone. We get in a car to Hama to meet Abu Aziz, who's already driven up from Damascus. Maliki is anxious and frustrated.
I didn't sleep well, actually.
So what are you hoping? You're going to see these guys and what?
To end this madness, man. To end this madness. I think we've been in this case 3 days now.
Yeah.
The f*** is this, man? 3 days? 3 days for a f- comedy show? They are wrong, okay? They are the political... They are wrong. But we didn't play well. When we play, we give them our neck.
We get to the political affairs office and inside a large, drab, concrete government building. At the door, the security guard says they're expecting us, and Maliki tightens. Up a dim stairwell to a large office, three suited officials sit in a row like judges facing out. One of them is the infamous Sheikh. We're shown to chairs by their side. Abu Aziz is already there. Maliki tells me to put my recorder outside again.
Please, we're going to take this outside, then we're going to talk.
All right.
The meeting begins. It's all in Arabic, but my translator is there and takes notes. The government officials are stern and condescending. Their age and authority looms over Abu Aziz and Maliki. They have the room. The men from political affairs tell the comedians they were insulted by Abu Aziz's post, that it's unacceptable to compare them to the Assad regime. They ask Abu Aziz how many people saw his post. He says 47,000 and apologizes, says what he did was wrong. The officials say that in addition to the post being inappropriate, it wasn't true. They never cancelled the show. Maliki pushes back. That's what his fixer was told when he had gone to pay the fees for the show. Whatever the truth of that, the three officials do have a lot to say about the content of the shows. One of them says that he went to one of their shows a few months back, that he sat in the front row with his son. He says, "I regretted bringing him, but what calmed me was that he fell asleep during the show. From the start, all your jokes were about religion, sex, and sensitive topics that threaten civil peace." They remind the comedians that under Assad, they could joke about anything but politics. Now, they can joke as much as they want about politics or the government, but they can't joke about topics that could disturb the civil peace. They point to a little dance Abu Aziz does at the start of his set. They say it's sexual. They say society's morals have deteriorated. Abu Aziz apologizes a second time. The meeting wraps up after an hour. Afterwards, I ask Abu Aziz about it.
Do you regret the post now?
Yes, from my, I regret my reaction and putting the story, because if I do that and comparing them to the old regime, if I do that with the old regime, they will, I will be killed or forcibly disappeared. But the new government have at least sat with me, discussed the issue with me, and they let me leave.
It says a lot about where Syria is now. Not the old terror, not real freedom either. The state will absolve you if you apologize, rather than make you disappear into the prison system. You can post, you can film, you can even argue in a room like that, but you have to bow down to authority, which, after 50 years of dictatorship, Syrians know how to do.
It seems to me like in Syria today, everyone has tasted freedom for the first time, and they're not sure what to do with it. Even the government don't even know what to do with freedom.
Yes, of course, you have said it in a lot. We are learning and they are learning.
I spoke to the Sheikh afterwards. He reiterated that he didn't cancel the show. He said his remit is cultural centers only, and the comedians are banned from the cultural centres in Hama. But anything in a private venue, he said, is outside his authority. He never told anyone to stop anything.
He is lying, man.
I told Maliki about the conversation.
He said it was a misunderstanding.
No, that's what they say after when feel the heat. You know, I'm sorry, it's a misunderstanding.
you are misunderstanding. Understand well, because you are in a position, you have to understand well. Any misunderstanding can lead to blood. You have to be aware of what kind of business you do.
I also learned the sheikh is not actually a sheikh.
Did you call all the politicians sheikh?
Not all, only the Muslim one.
We tried to figure out who cancelled the show in Hamas and didn't get anywhere either. The next two shows are in Aleppo, and even though Maliki was worried about Aleppo from the start, the shows there are not cancelled. They sell out both shows, 1,000 tickets in total. Maliki does the joke about his dad, and one about being a Christian in a mosque. Sharif tells the bra joke. See? Maliki was right. They kill in Arabic.
Eamon Ogana is a reporter in Damascus. Our program is produced today by Dana Chivas and edited by Fia Benin, David Kestenbaum, with fact-checking by Hani Hawassli. Hiraf Ali Kurz worked with Eamon in Syria. Drew Taha did translations. Our website, thisamericanlife.org. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the public radio exchange. Support for This American Life comes from Odoo. Running a business means managing many different tools that don't always work together. Odoo. It's business software designed to bring those tools into one integrated platform. It includes applications for customer management, accounting, inventory, and e-commerce. Odoo is used by organizations seeking a single system to support daily operations. Learn more at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com. And for Progressive Insurance, from car insurance quotes to buying, Progressive Insurance offers a variety of ways to stay protected. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Thanks as always to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia. You know, when people walk up to him on the street before they barely get a word out, he lets them know,
I'm not George Clooney.
I'm Ira Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
Support for This American Life on KPR comes from KU Natural History Museum, participating in National Museum Selfie Day, January 21st. Selfie stations will be set up throughout the museum's galleries. Open 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Information at biodiversity.ku.edu. And the Topeka Symphony presenting Billy the Kid on Saturday, featuring Copland, Boyer, Debussy, and more. Information and tickets available at topekasymphony.org. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute, online at kansaspublicradio.org, or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio.
Welcome to The Middle, a weekly show where Americans from every corner of our country and across the political spectrum can meet in the middle for civil conversation. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's been just about 1 year since President Trump took office for the second time, although I think we've been through about a million news cycles. An unprecedented crackdown on illegal immigration, sweeping tariffs on friends and foes alike, huge cuts to government programs, a stock market that keeps hitting new records, and a campaign of retribution against anyone who crosses the president. So our question this hour is, how have Trump's policies in the past year affected you personally? Joining us, USA Today Chief Political Correspondent Philip Bailey and veteran CNN political correspondent Candy Crowley. This show was previously recorded, so we're not taking any more live calls, but you can leave us a message at 844-4MIDDLE. Stay right there. The Middle starts right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Pentagon is telling 1,500 active-duty troops in Alaska to prepare for possible deployment to Minnesota, NPR has confirmed. This amid growing protests after an ICE agent shot and killed Renee Macklin Good in Minneapolis earlier this month. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has opened criminal investigations into the state's governor and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey.
Of course, we will comply, in it, but at the same time, we need to be understanding how wild this is. And whether it's Senator Slotkin or Governor Walz or myself, this is not the way that we conduct ourselves in America.
Speaking there on ABC's This Week, President Trump is expected to announce a plan letting Americans use their retirement savings for down payments on homes at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, that starts tomorrow. Trump offered few details on how it will work, but the White House says he will present a final plan in Davos this week. Meanwhile, President Trump's approval rating hovers slightly above 40%, and he's been working to communicate to voters his plans to make life more affordable. Implementation? That's another matter. NPR's Daniel Kurzleben reports.
Some of Trump's ideas he has been able to enact himself, like pulling back tariffs he himself instituted on some foods and beverages. Some he would need Congress to pass, like the outline of a health care plan he pitched, which would give Affordable Care Act subsidy money directly to consumers. Speaker Mike Johnson has given a tepid response to another new Trump idea to cap credit card interest rates at 10%. Trump has been putting more energy into the affordability message since Democrats won November elections by leaning into that topic. However, his administration's attack on Venezuela, ICE troops in Minneapolis, and threats to Greenland have often overshadowed that message. Danielle Kurzleben, NPR News.
Syrian government forces have taken control of another major city in northern Syria, NPR's Emily Fang reports.
On Sunday, Israel's energy minister wrote on the social media site X that he'd moved to implement legislation passed in December to cut off utilities to UNRWA. That's the agency that for decades has provided many social services in Palestinian communities in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, though in 2024, Israel banned it from Israeli territory. Israel has accused UNRWA of being infiltrated by Hamas, and while the agency has denied the allegations, it fired around two dozen of its employees as a result. Last week, Israeli security forces raided an UNRWA healthcare center in East Jerusalem. UNRWA still runs facilities in the occupied West Bank, but says that those schools and healthcare facilities will close down soon if their water and power are cut. Emily Fang, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Wall Street is closed tomorrow in observance of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. This is NPR News. More cities are turning to artificial intelligence to help address homelessness using data and predictive algorithms to try to stop it before it starts. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports.
Cities like Los Angeles are using predictive algorithms to scan everything from emergency room visits to public benefits records, identifying people most at risk of losing housing. Janie Roundtree, executive director of the California Policy Lab at UCLA, says the goal is early intervention.
We are never going to solve the problem of homelessness unless we can not only house people who are already experiencing homelessness, we also have to prevent it before it happens. You need to be able to find those people in time to help them.
People flagged by the system get a call from a case manager and possibly one-time financial help. But critics warn the technology could raise privacy concerns and deepen existing inequities. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
In southern Spain, at least 20 people are dead after two high-speed trains collided tonight. Officials say one of the trains derailed and then jumped onto the track of a train coming in the opposite direction, hitting that oncoming train. Dozens are injured. Officials say the accident happened in a hard-to-reach area and that local residents were helping people on the trains with blankets and with water. So far, there's no word on the cause of the accident. Asian markets are trading slightly lower at this hour. The Asia Dow is down about 0.1%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Support for The Middle comes from the stations that air the show and from you. Thanks for making a donation at listentothemiddle.com.
Welcome to The Middle. I'm Jeremy Hobson, and our DJ Tolliver is here as well. Yep. And Tolliver, as is often the case, people are living very different lives in this country depending on where they are right now. If you look at the top story in the Minneapolis Star Tribune as we go to air, it is Trump threatens to send troops to Minnesota. If you look at the Miami Herald, it is Trump meets with Machado, the opposition leader from Venezuela, but keeps channels open with Venezuelan regime leaders. And if you look at the Houston Chronicle, the top story is, here's what Houston residents complained about most in 2025. I'm not kidding. That is
is that our topic today?
That is not our topic, unfortunately.
Shame.
That would be good. But no, that is the outlier because, as you know, Trump is part of almost all the news all the time now. And believe it or not, it has been just about 1 year since he took office for the second time. A lot has happened in that year, and Trump is quite proud.
We've set all-time records for the lowest number of illegal border crossings ever recorded. Think of that, ever recorded.
We ended the war in Gaza and really, on a much bigger basis, created peace. A lot of winning out there, and we're having a good day in the stock market, as you can see, an all-time record day, and hopefully it continues. I think it should. We have many people that don't work. We have many people probably that aren't even living that are getting checks. And we're finding all of that out, and it's being reported. We're going to save hundreds of billions of dollars.
Trump's critics, meanwhile, have a much different assessment of the past year.
Every day, Donald Trump is making this nation look more and more like a fascist state.
ICE is harassing people for not being white. That's not making America great.
And if Americans want proof that Donald Trump's trade war has been a catastrophe, considering this, while he capitulates to Beijing, he's raising tariffs on Canada. How nonsensical, how stupid, how thoughtless.
So this hour, we want to know how you've been affected personally, if you have, by Trump's policies. Did you lose your job because of DOGE cuts? Do you know someone who's been deported in the president's immigration crackdown? Are you putting in a pool because your stock portfolio is through the roof? Or has your life been relatively unaffected? You can call in at 844-4MIDDLE. That's 844-464-3353. Or you can write to us at listentothemiddle.com. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, last week we asked what socialism means to you as Zoran Mamdani became New York City's first Democratic socialist mayor. Here are some of the voicemails we got.
This is Jack from Easton, Pennsylvania. There's two kinds of socialism. There's authoritarian socialism, such as existed in the Soviet Union, where the people really had no electoral power. And then there's democratic socialism, which is responsive to the voters.
Hi, my name is Ann Hogan. I'm from Lowell, Mass. When I think of socialism, I think of the Karl Marx comment, from each according to ability to each according to need, which is a kind way of looking at helping people in society who have less than others.
Hi, this is Noah. I'm calling from South Carolina. I think when we look at socialism in other countries, it tends not to go like super, super well. But on the other hand, I think the way that we're doing capitalism in America is really not working either.
Well, thanks to everyone who called in. As always, you can hear that whole show by subscribing to The Middle wherever you get your podcasts. And here are new weekly podcast extra, The Follow-Up, which includes more of your comments. So now to our topic this hour. How has the first year of Trump's second presidency affected you personally? Tolliver, how can people reach us?
You can call us at 844-4MIDDLE. That's 844-464-3353. Or you can write to us at listentothemiddle.com or comment on our live stream on YouTube or TikTok or Instagram, all the places.
Well, joining us this hour, USA Today chief political correspondent Philip Bailey. Hi, Philip.
Jeremy, what's going on?
And veteran CNN political correspondent Candy Crowley. Candy, welcome back to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, I think we may have some recency bias in this conversation because it's hard to look past what has been happening in Minnesota, in Venezuela, threatening to take over Greenland. But, Philip, if you look at the last year, what do you think is the biggest change for most Americans?
Well, look, America is a different place, and I think that when you look at President Trump's return to office, right, it's sort of stunning in the scope in which he's been able to touch, not just in politics, but even in culture. We see some changes even there with his advent, you know, his return to power. I would say that it's pretty obvious that the crackdown immigration, putting ICE agents, you know, adding how many different ICE officers to that agency, sending the National Guard, the use of force, military force, in cities in particular, I think, is rather stunning when you consider that the last time we really saw a president do this was, you know, sometimes in like the late 1960s or in the early 1960s during the Civil Rights era. So that to me would be probably the most obvious answer to what has Donald Trump changed in his first year since he's been back in power.
Candy, what do you think? Where are Americans feeling the president's policies the most?
You know, I thought a lot about this since I knew I was going to be on talking about this question. And honestly, if I had to say one thing, it's not a policy. It's certainly, you know, what's going on with ICE is to me the major thing. But I think it's what all of this causes. People say all the time, Wall Street hates uncertainty, which does make you wonder why it's doing so well. But nonetheless, Main Street doesn't like uncertainty either. So if you talk to people, and I have friends that are in Michigan, I'm in Washington now, but that are very Trump-oriented. I have a lot of friends that are not Trump-oriented. All of them feel this sort of sense of anxiety. Right. It's the kind of like, and now what's happened in this 5 minutes and what does that mean? And to me, it's a sort of a broader thing than one policy. It's the uncertainty of what next.
And Candy, on the issue of the economy, which tends to be one of the most important issues to voters, Trump now has a 36% approval on the economy in a new Reuters Ipsos poll. Do you think the economy, given everything you just said, is still the most important thing for people and how they're feeling personally about their economy?
Sure. Although I think the last week of ICE in Minnesota certainly does has gotten a lot of attention. The video of this woman being shot in the face 3 times, I saw somewhere over 80% of Americans have seen that. So it would say to me that this week, the whole kind of militarization of the streets of America or of the streets of democratic cities, however you want to look at it, has taken over. But I think in the long run, it's almost always pocketbook. And I think it still is, particularly since you don't know where it's going. You know, I feel so badly for small businesses who don't know what's the Supreme Court going to do? And then after the Supreme Court does what it does, what's Donald Trump going to do? And then what was Congress going to do? And so it's so roiled and it makes everyone feel unstable. And the first place you feel unstable is, can I pay my bills? Can I still pay for college for my child? That kind of thing. So I think the big undertow is the economy. But boy, some things come along that are just sort of giant waves on top of it.
A lot of uncertainty. But Philip, you know, we've done shows about the economy and we've heard from small business owners who are feeling the effects of the tariffs that have really changed their entire business model because of how much they get from China or from other countries. What's your sense right now of how Americans are feeling Trump's economy?
Well, look, I think Donald Trump has learned that it's easier said than done, right, to fix and tame the American economy. We all remember it was not too long ago, a few short years ago, the Biden administration kept telling Americans, don't worry, look at the big macro improvements in the economy. And the American people weren't feeling it. Well, now Donald Trump is learning that on his side, on the governing side, not on the campaign side, a lot of those big promises he made, Jeremy, during that campaign, I think we oftentimes forget, you know, President Trump made some pretty bold, outrageous sort of promises, right? Like saying he was going to halve or cut in half energy costs. In fact, energy costs are going in the opposite direction by about 41%. So look, I think Donald Trump is learning as he sees some of his own supporters, particularly younger, white, working class men, some of whom I've talked to, who aren't really feeling the Trump improvement or the Trump boom that he talks about on the campaign trail, talks about when he's touring the rest of the country. I think that for him has been more difficult than he wants to admit. Even allies say that, look, they're looking for some things to come online later on in the year with the tax returns and the One Big Beautiful Bill. But I don't see that there's a lot of confidence, and a lot of folks are having buyer's remorse right now.
Candy, let me just ask you about one more thing before we start getting into some calls, which is the retribution that Trump takes on people that cross him. Now, that may not be felt by ordinary Americans, but I wonder if it is when, you know, the Fed chair refuses to bow to the president on interest rates and he gets investigated, or Republican members of Congress say they want the Epstein files released and Trump just completely turns on them, or the universities around the country that lose their funding because they do something that he doesn't like. Do Americans feel?